to this week's Animal Talk Naturally, empowering you with unlearning to care for your animals naturally. I'm Kim Bloomer, your host, and this week's show is entitled Wild Thing. I think I love you, but I want to know for sure. Come on, hold me tight. You move me. Well, actually, the title of the show is just Wild Thing, but I couldn't help myself. I think Jeannie knew I was going to do that. This week, we are talking about cats, feral cats, and hence the title of the show. Before we get into the topic, and we're going to be visiting again with a former guest, let me just give you a couple of announcements, and this one really goes to the topic of the day also. You guys remember Colleen Page, founder of National Dog Day? Well, on August 15th, my birthday is going to be National Cat Day. And if you want to learn more about it and be supportive of this really wonderful event, go to www.nationalcatday.org. Would also like to bring to your attention nationalpetpress.com. This is a great place for those of you who are who have a pet-centric business or just love animals or and want to find cool things for them. You can either advertise there or check out the newsletter that's going to be coming out where you can find out everything to do with pets. And we would really like to support this organization, and you're probably going to be hearing more about nationalpetpress.com on Animal Talk Naturally. Well, this week we have with us our special guest, Penny Leash. Penny is an author, a published author, and photographer, and she does a lot of wildlife and animal photography. She is she's an accomplished animal rescuer, which I think is really great. She's been doing this for a long time, and we're very pleased to have her back with us. If you'll recall, Penny was our guest back in September talking about dogs, and she was also an I guess you would say, what is that called when you do voting, absentee voting? It's the same thing. She did a pre-recorded version of Traveling with Pets that was part of our online dog expo back in September. And here's the cool part. During that time, Penny was packing and moving across two states. So, Penny, welcome. It's wonderful to have you back with us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. Yes, we were. We moved from Arizona to Texas, and that involved trying to do closings on two homes, pack and move four animals, and travel 1,500 miles and do all of it in less than 30 days.
That's how I found that so amazing that you were able to squeeze in time to record a special, this special Traveling with Pets, which I find really, really important that people need to know more about. And so my first question for you, Penny, is going to be exactly about that. How did your pets fare? How did that all go, that whole move from not only a different climate, but traveling across two states with your pets and everything, and then into this humid climate that you now are in Texas?
Actually, the move went very well. The animals travel with us. We have a camper, small Class C motorhome type vehicle. We do not fly them. I'm quite adamant about not flying animals. I don't have a problem with them flying in the cabin under the seat in carriers. I'm sure it's very stressful for them. But the baggage compartment type flying is, in my opinion, not a very good option unless it's an absolute necessity. We have our cats and dogs, even the ones that aren't used to traveling. We take them out fairly regularly to keep them at least acquainted with being in the car. We have a situation set up where we can put each kitty in a carrier, and they have tie downs. The dogs have seat belts, and we have arranged our vehicle in such a way that they have their own space and they have some privacy and some comfort, and that they're safely restrained during the travel. We make sure that we stop regularly for them to have food, water, litter breaks, and get some exercise. We have ramps for the steps because we have old animals and they don't make it up and down those steps very easily. So it's mostly planning, and with some planning and some patience, it's like traveling with children. You're just not going to do 800 miles a day, and you've got to be willing to change your plans when necessary.
Penny, you mentioned something really interesting to me when you said you stopped for litter breaks because, you know, traveling with dogs, I often stop for them to take potty breaks as well. And, you know, I never really thought about that with the cat. Can you tell us a little bit more about it? You obviously take a litter box along with you, and how often do you need to stop and take those litter breaks for the kitties?
Well, litter breaks for cats can be handled two different ways. We have fairly large carriers that you would use for a medium-sized dog that will actually hold a small litter pan and still allow the cat plenty of room to be comfortable. That's our preferred method for the cats. However, we have had a couple of cats that just do not accept it. They tear up the carrier, dump over the litter pans and things when we put too much in there. Therefore, we also carry a litter pan. And when they feel that way about it and they're not amenable to having the litter pan in with them, the stopping is just about like you would do for yourself or for a dog. You can, sometimes it's as short as 2 hours, other times it'll be 3 or 4 hours. But when you're ready for a stretch break and a potty break, they probably are too. In our case, we keep the litter box and a little cat tree up on the upper bunk where everything is out of the way of the dogs, and the cats go up and the dogs go down.
Well, Penny, would you tell us how many pets were traveling with you when you were going across basically three states?
Four. We have a 70-pound white shepherd. We have about a 60-pound basset hound. They are both around 11 or 12 years old. We have two cats. One has a disc turned sideways in his back and walks like he's skating, so he's, we suspect, older. And we have a young one that is a Maine Coon.
Are you kidding? I love that breed of cat. Oh, those are so awesome. Well, you know what? I have a question for you about, I know I like the big ones, and I like the ones that are more like a bobcat-looking animal. Of course, I like Siamese, too. What don't? If it's got fur, I probably like it. I was really wondering about how you got into rescuing animals. I know you've been doing it for a long time, so would you tell our audience about how long you've been doing this and what motivated you to do that?
Well, it was kind of an evolutionary process. I always had pets as I was growing up, and then when I got older, my children were always bringing something home, and they usually ended up staying. At that point, they were kitties because I was a single parent and I was working, so dogs were difficult for us to manage. And then when I got older, my husband was already doing cat rescue. He was working for the Animal Welfare League in Arizona, providing foster homes back in the days before they had a shelter, and back in the days when anything that you did with the fosters was out of your own pocket. And he had several kitties. When we got married, we inherited those together, and I had all of the ones that were unadoptable. We had one that had three legs, one that was deaf, one that was cross-eyed, one that had something else going on. I can't remember at this point. And I came to the marriage with mostly a horse and a dog background. He had the cat background. And over the years, we've just grown together on that. And now it's evolved into a number of other things. And then as I've worked with the different rescue groups through my Reiki training, I've dealt with more with horses. I've dealt with rats and birds and a number of other species.
You just like animals, it sounds like. Well, I know today we're going to be talking about feral cats. And you know what? I think the first question many people might ask is, what in the world is a feral cat? We keep hearing feral cat. What does that mean?
Well, feral cats are not wildlife in the sense of like a squirrel or a bobcat or a deer. They're feral because they're what means they're wild. However, they are wild only because they are afraid of people. They don't survive without direct or indirect support from humans, like a true wild animal may. They're wild in the sense that they become afraid of people because they have been abandoned. Generally, a feral population starts with a domestic cat that was somebody's pet that was left behind. That cat breeds, and those kittens in one generation become what are called feral cats because they have no contact with humans during that initial period of their life. They become afraid of people and the term feral then applies, because they're usually not able to be tamed once they get past that first 12 weeks. Small domestic cats, most people don't realize, have only been in North America a few hundred years. They were introduced by European immigrants. And the ferals are no different than a household cat. It's that lack of human interaction in those first couple of months that classifies them as a feral cat and in puts them in the position of being afraid of people.
Okay, so a lot of times then what you're saying could be barn cats that haven't had a whole lot of socialization. Now, Emily's here in the audience, and she said that she has farm friends who have barn cats whose population gets out of control, and then the later generations end up afraid of people. So do you think that besides abandonment, it could be just a lot of farm cats that aren't controlled at some point, so that they're just, you know, breeding like animals will, because they're acting more in accordance with nature, and then you have a situation. And I mean, you could have in a barn, we need them, of course, for the mice and so forth, but I mean, you could end up with way too many of them. I know I have a friend who lives on a ranch here in New Mexico, and she, you know, they end up with quite a lot of cats, and as she gets them, she spays or neuters them, so I'm sure we're going to talk about that in a bit too.
Yes. Barn cats may or may not be domestic, in the sense that it depends on how much contact they have with the people. But as you were saying, after they've had a number of litters and those litters have run wild and were not originally raised in the house or cuddled by the people and handled frequently, then they become more and more wild. The term applies more to the socialization than it does to anything specific to the cat. Many times when there's a feral population whose environment is at risk and their life is at stake, because that environment will cease to exist, a building being razed or a situation where they have to be moved, it's ideally not the first choice to move a colony, but many of them are relocated to farms just for that reason, because they can be helpful and there's a mutual benefit, but they are not going to be tameable. So they can live out their existence under those circumstances in a nice, safe environment. And yes, I would definitely recommend spaying and neutering if you need an ongoing population. There are so many kitties out there that are available and don't have homes that would be quite pleased to come and join you.
Penny, do you think that a lot of these cats, though, that are feral, because I know we've had one that was in our yard for a while. He was cute as could be, but, of course, my dog wasn't real happy with him hanging out in our yard, so he doesn't come in our yard anymore. Got a little bit frightened by him, you know, and Shadrach's a big dog. So, but I just wonder, do you think that primarily in cities that these cats are abandoned cats, you know, where somebody didn't do the responsible thing and spay or neuter their cat, and then they got out and bred, and then they just dumped the mom and the litter and everything else?
Yes, that is very often the case. Although cats have a reputation for independence, they are not asocial, and as we said, they generally start from an abandoned cat. The feral colony I had in Arizona that I was caring for was definitely started that way. We had a lot of rental homes around. People would get a cat, and they would either leave it behind, or they adopt a cat from a shelter, or they go buy a kitten. They do not spay and neuter it, and that cat runs the neighborhood, and then it has kittens, and those kittens continue to run the neighborhood, only they weren't the ones that were adopted, so people sometimes don't care for them or don't bring them inside or take any further responsibility. And what I've seen happen many times is that it's even the domestic cats that are cared for become a part of the problem if people don't spay and neuter, because when they get out, they will breed with that abandoned cat, and pretty soon you have a feral colony started. So it's not only the existing ferals that are part of the problem, but the cats that have owners that don't take the responsibility to eliminate the breeding potential or keep them inside that become a part of the problem.
Penny, I'm just wondering, what if someone were to have a quote-unquote feral cat wander into their yard and they decided that they wanted to keep it as a pet? How easy is it to transform this kind of wild animal back into a friendly house pet?
It's not easy. Generally, the feral kittens can be tamed in the first up to about 8 weeks. If you get them young enough, they can generally be tamed. However, there's some excellent information on alleycat.org about dealing with feral kittens. An adult feral is not very likely to be tamed. Once in a while, you may get lucky. If it's a first generation, maybe a cat that was abandoned and has just become primarily feral because of lack of attention and human contact, but has at one time had a home, you may be able to convince it that you're safe. There have been exceptions when people have had ferals that would come up to them and allow them to be petted. In many cases, though, they would never come in the house. They were never trainable. They were never safe around people in the sense that they can become scared very easily. They are essentially wild at that point, and you can build a shelter for them. You can put a feeding station for them. There's an awful lot you can do for them, but making a pet out of them is not an opportunity that's very likely to be successful.
Well, we have a couple of questions from Emily in the audience, and she wanted to know if inbreeding becomes a problem with feral colonies, because she says, I know that some of these later generations that we mentioned earlier, they have mutations or are a little quote-unquote crazier than, say, the previous generation. Is that inbreeding?
It might be. Cat breeding is a very different art in itself, because as some of you may know, and I'm not sure if everyone knows that, but when a queen has a litter, they may have different fathers. That's not a common thing that we're used to with people and with some breeds of animals. But so when they breed among their own litter, they may or may not be inbred in varying degrees. The other thing can be that they could have been affected by illnesses. Their health could be compromised from a lack of nutrition as a kitten if they're not in a colony that's being cared for. Being outside, there are any number of things. They may be ill, and it may not be a contagious illness in terms of being a danger to the neighborhood or the population, but that doesn't mean that they don't have any type of disease. Our cats that live to be 18 years old and are healthy and happy have medical care that's better than what people had 100 years ago.
Oh, I agree. That's and what's really funny about that is, you know, you never think about that with really wild animals. And I'm saying really as opposed to these animals that were domesticated and then abandoned and created their own colonies, partly, I'm sure, just because it's a natural thing, but also because it's out of necessity. But I'm just wondering if, you know, if these kind of things are happening just because, well, I really think all of these problems go right back to the human problem. Let's take a little different turn here, Penny, and talk about, you know how people always say cats are really independent, they don't really care about us, and I even have this thing on my wall that my sister gave me, and it says, dogs think they're human and cats think they're God. You know, cats are aloof and dogs are the friendly little best friends and so forth. So are cats really as independent thinking, or do they actually have a social structure? And I would venture to say they probably do, especially if they're forming these colonies on their own.
Oh, yes, you're entirely right, they do. Although they do have a reputation for independence, they're not asocial. They exhibit cooperative behavior in a lot of ways if you watch them. They have communication, the various meowing calls that they make to each other, they reciprocate back and forth. They form long-term relationships. Some of the greatest communication and cooperation is among the mother cats that will often cooperatively raise their young. Female cats are even known to perform midwife services for each other, such as cleaning kittens and eating the placenta when they're in a wild colony like that. Yes, they do. They have something like 30-some different meowing sounds that they've identified. And one activity called allo-rubbing is similar to when humans hug each other, and it also helps mark the colony members with a recognizable scent. And in cats, the adult cats are very important to the kittens, which is one reason that it's so difficult to tame them past a certain age. There is a vast amount of social learning that takes place during those first 4 months, and kittens that are isolated from an adult cat, they don't learn to hunt, they don't learn to understand feline social signals, and that isolation leaves them without the proper social and survival skills. And this is true of family kittens that are rehomed very young due to being orphaned or something too.
Emily had another question. How about purring? She's heard, you know, has the source been identified, and she heard it can signal pain, and maybe why people, I mean, contentment, I'm sure, but maybe why people have mistakenly thought it signals pain is because when a cat is injured, they will purr because they have a frequency, an electrical frequency in their body that is similar to, Jeannie and I both use essential oils, so we know that this is an equivalent frequency that can heal. So a lot of times if you have a house full of cats and you're sick, you're going to find them sitting all around you or near you or on you, helping you to get well as well. So I think that's really awesome. Has that been your experience also, Penny?
Yes, it has. And they really don't know what the source is, but there is even a CD out, and I don't know the name of it, that has various cat purring that is used, as you say, for healing, sort of a meditation or healing frequency like music. And they do, I think, just as dogs sometimes do, make a lot of different sounds. And we don't really know what all those sounds are. One of the interesting parts of nature is that the animals are much better at learning our language than we are at learning theirs. They are quite easily multilingual. They understand the signals of the social signals of other animals around them and of other species around them, and they have to survive. But yet, when you think about it, how many of us are able to adapt to that many different cultures and language, even if our survival depends on it? We're not nearly as good at it as they are.
I know, and they're just so resourceful. And Shadrach is having a conversation here because the Albuquerque Journal is here taking photos. You want to say hi, Dean?
Hi there.
Could you guys hear him? They heard you. I know you're talking, Chad. We're talking about cats today. Well, tell me this, Penny. You know, these what happens to all these orphan kittens, or if they're taken away from a colony to be tamed? What happens with that whole situation? And do these animals make good pets?
The young kittens will make very good pets. And while it may take more time to work with them and more patience than it will when one comes from a domestic household and is used to people initially, they will make very good pets. They just need a lot more patience, and it's going to be a slower process of domesticating them, and the younger they are, the better off they are. However, when taming them, it's helpful to have an adult cat around if you do happen to have an adult around that's tolerant of kittens. Now, that said, this is probably a project that's best left to the pros in that sense. It's if you're going to try to make a regular project out of it, they will mimic the other cat's behavior and learn feline communication, but it's still not easy to teach a cat to be a cat. And adult cats, especially males, are sometimes not safe around very young kittens. In the wild, the adult males can and do kill kittens. And without a mother cat, the tamed kittens will never have a full set of cat survival and social skills. So they shouldn't be indoor-outdoor cats, and they should not be put in to multi-cat situations without a very careful, slow assimilation with a lot of supervision and gentle monitoring from the people involved.
Well, have you ever brought any of those kittens into your home? I mean, have you ever worked with them or had one or adopted one, I guess, I don't know, a rescued one?
No, I have not. I had one at one point. However, because I have an immune system disorder, they do not recommend that I work with them because there is a far higher risk of getting bit or scratched or something like that. So I do not work with the kittens. I did have one that I rescued that I trapped. I had in with me for several days that then found a home at a with a family that specialized in doing nothing but taming and raising the feral kittens and then finding them new families. And fortunately, she turned out to be 100% healthy when they got her checked out, and they named her after me. And she was just a little doll, but it is like dealing with a tiger in miniature.
Oh, you know, and Jeannie has one, but her kitty seems to be kind of rules the outdoor roost, I think, huh, Jeannie? That kind of leads us to the TNR, and we hear about TNR, and I think a lot of people maybe are afraid to not ask what these acronyms mean. I'm not one of those. I'll ask what something means if I don't know, but again, this is the trap, neuter, release, and could you just tell us what that means, Penny, and how a TNR program works?
Gladly. The TNR, yes, trap, neuter, release, or trap, neuter, return. You'll hear it both ways, and I can tell you from personal experience, these programs work. The colony I cared for in Arizona went from 10 cats to 3 cats over a period of about 3 years after the breeding was stopped. And the trap and neuter is usually a free or low-cost service provided by a local shelter or one of the government city county agencies that are running a program. And some of them provide traps for free, or they have a low deposit and a rental if people are willing and able to do that part themselves. And they'll give instructions or a short class on how to do it properly and safely. Then they refer the cats to vets that agree to do the spay and neuter at a reduced cost. Now, in some cases, that's also paid in full. Other times, it's a donation of what the people can afford. Various locations run them in different ways. In most cases, the cats are dropped off in the morning, and then they're picked up in the evening. Some of them keep them overnight. Some of them keep them up to 2 nights, especially on the spays versus the neuters. Usually, even if the vet doesn't keep them, they request that you keep the cats overnight in a safe place like a garage or a sheltered area. They've been without food, they've been through general anesthesia, they've been through surgery, so they can't fend for themselves and they don't need to be out in the open yet and on their own. They can be offered food and water later in the evening, and this is accomplished because the traps have a separate door in the back where a person can reach in and do the food and do the water and be able to give them something without them being able to get out or get to you. And then you raise the door in the middle and they have access to the food and water. These are multi-doored traps that are humane and they're large enough for the cat to be comfortable and they're easy to take care of and give them all of the necessities without a risk to the handler or to the person to the cat. And then by the following afternoon, they're usually ready to be released. The entire process takes about 3 days for a few cats that are easy to catch. Now, I've had a couple cats that took up to 2 weeks to catch and required doing a lot of special trapping techniques, but that's that's another story entirely. And it's not as bad as it sounds because one day the traps are set probably around dinner time. Then the cats are held in the garage or overnight out of the weather. Because remember, they can't move around to keep warm or anything, so they need some protection. And the next day they're taken to the vet and sometimes brought back the same day. Then they're monitored overnight, given food, let the medication wear off, and then they're ready to go. It's really not something that consumes all of your time. There's just a few things that have to be done along the way. And then after the release, the program that arranged the spay and neuter usually requires the caregiver to continue to provide food and water for the colony. And the feeding commitment, in my experience, is best shared. It's nice if you can get several neighbors to share it because it makes it easier when people go on vacation or move or become sick. It's hard when you're the only one. I know this because I was the only one in Arizona. The population around us was very mobile. People were buying, selling, leaving all the time. A lot of rental homes in the area. And so when we had to move, it was hard for me to find someone to care for my colony, and as a result, I had to pay the boy next door, the teenager, to take care of the feeding station. They did agree to have it moved onto their property, but as a result, I'm also still paying for the food for that colony because it was the only way that I could manage to make sure that even though there were only two or three left, that these cats were cared for and not just abandoned again.
That's right. On that note, we're going to take a short break and we'll be right back. Naniaki Linder is an author, mentor, and a foremost lecturer in Wisdom Speaks training for warrior speakers. If your goal is to join the ranks of the best, then Nani's program is for you. By infusing motivational enthusiasm into her workshops and discussions, Nani shares a rare depth of knowledge and true life insights not taught in books. She guides and draws out the best of you to share with the world. This infusion of sagacity with modern and ancient insights is fun, energetic, and captures the meaningful essence of you. So the skills you learn become as natural as breathing air. Nani also teaches the value in the art of seeing through the eyes of others you are privileged to serve. Hearts and minds are uplifted by all who are fortunate enough to participate in her Wisdom Speaks mentoring and warrior training, and I'm one of them. She works passionately as a speaker, trainer, and entrepreneur, and invites you to call her for a free 15-minute consultation at 509-467-7714. That's 509-467-7714. Pick up the phone and call. You'll be glad you did, and I can attest to that fact. You can also find Nani at www.nanilinder.com. That's www.nanilinder.com. And now, back to our show.
Hi, this is Tammy Munson from the Pod Talk Divas. You're listening to Animal Talk Naturally with Kim Bloomer and Jeannie Thomason.
We're back, and we were just talking about how Penny does her trap, neuter, release, or how she explained what that means and how that happens. And, you know, it's interesting. Jeannie was saying that they had a program when she worked for a veterinarian. I believe that's what you said, Jeannie, that where you spay neutered a lot of feral cats for free to people who caught them. And we had a program similar to that at the veterinarian I worked at. And I remember there was one man who always brought in the feral cats, and we think, okay, everybody gear up, because I'll tell you what, I would rather face a growling dog at that point than the feral cats. They were pretty interesting because they had four paws with claws and teeth. So it was always interesting. I was always relieved once we had them anesthetized so we could do that. But again, at the same time, it was a very, very good program because, you know, we knew that that cat was no longer going to be able to go out and reproduce more. So that it was good, but my heart was always in my throat during those times when we were getting ready to do another one of spay or neuter, another one of those, Penny. And I don't know if you've experienced that, but they are pretty tricky even in the cages. So I think people should probably be a little careful, shouldn't they?
Oh, yes, they definitely should. And yes, I have, because I've had as many as 10 at a time in my garage. And they are, the people that are pregnant or have immune system diseases should not deal with them because, you know, they are outside. They are not taken care for on a regular basis. You don't know what animals they've been in contact with. So just to be safe, it's best to be cautious if you have any health issues. There's always a risk of a scratch or a bite. And one of the things people have to realize is, yes, they look very cute and cuddly, and they are very scared, and there is a temptation to think, oh, well, I'll just pet them, or they'll be okay. They're sitting there quietly. They're not moving. They're not making any noise. They're fine. They're not wild. The quieter they are, the louder they can go off, and that's something that those of us who've done it learn from experience, too. They're not happy in traps. They're not happy riding in cars. They're not happy when they're in pain after surgery. I mean, I don't think you would be either. And so these are times that to be careful, keep your hands out, and don't attempt to do anything. Let the pros take care of it, because if you've ever watched, you were talking about being in the vet's office. When you watch a vet's office, they usually have towels. They know how these cages operate. They end up using a nice soft towel or something and pushing the door in and moving the kitty back in the corner and getting a shot of tranquilizer into them before anyone ever tries to handle them. And they know how to do it without hurting the cat, but it takes practice. It takes multiple hands, and no one wants either one of you to be hurt.
Well, and that's it. You know, and again, we appreciated what this one man was doing on a regular basis. But I'll tell you what, it was always a gulp moment for me to have to say, oh no, we get to anesthetize this one now, you know. And cats use a different kind of anesthesia than you do dogs, so it's quite different. But once you have them anesthetized, it's really actually quite easier than a dog, because of not having to do different kinds of anesthesia, where you just get them down and you're able to do it. And they're also relatively, I think, easier to just go ahead and do the surgery, just from assisting enough. Mm-hmm. Both Jeannie and I have. So, but the gulp part was getting them anesthetized in the first place. So you got to be careful. You know, I mean, while we think of them as domestic animals, when they've been in a feral colony long enough and for enough generations, they are, you know, they are more wild and not used to human interaction and afraid of us too. It was interesting though, Penny, that the kitty that we had in our yard, who was coming into our yard, he didn't seem to be afraid of us at all. Not even afraid of my dog. I mean, I saw him. I was watching him one day when my dog went out in the yard, and I thought, oh my God, I hope he doesn't see that cat. He was blending into the greenery in my garden, and I thought, I hope he doesn't move. And the cat just laid there and watched him and was not afraid. And it was another incident where he happened to not know that my dog was there, and he came into the yard, and there was a ensuing chase. So I guess the old animosity just kind of rears up in those animals who aren't raised or reared around cats, and we'll probably talk about that before the end of the show a little bit about the cat and dog phenomena. But what are the advantages to the community, Penny, for doing a TNR program? Because, you know, a lot of people might think, oh, and this is very sad, but this is how a lot of people think, why don't you just euthanize them? Why do you trap them, spay and neuter them, and then release them back into the wild?
Yes, that's a common question. And so let's start from the beginning there. One of the advantages is that you eliminate the male spraying and things stinking from cats running around marking territory, because cats are territorial. You eliminate the yowling when the females are in heat. You eliminate additional kittens being born and not having homes either, and trying to unfortunately, even if you can't find homes for all of them, the bottom line is they probably will be euthanized if they get removed from the colony. And so there are all of those things are advantages to the community. And, of course, not having the population continue to grow is an advantage to the community also, because the fewer the cats, the fewer the environmental disruption. In terms of why they don't just euthanize them or exterminate them in some manner, the fact is cats are territorial and more cats will move in. They've never found a way to make that work. Most communities just, they do not have the time, the money, the resources to make that work on a large scale basis, because somewhere down the line, someone else is going to leave their cat behind, let their cat out, not have their cat spayed or neutered. And what happens is that when that territory is empty and available, more cats move in. So this doesn't really solve the problem. It slows it down temporarily for maybe a few months or perhaps even a year or two, but in the long run, it's not solving anything. When you do the spay and neuter, they maintain their territory. They actually keep other cats out. They're not continuing to breed, and through normal aging and attrition, and things that just happen like that, that population will continue to decline when it's not breeding. And in some cases, the population, even when it was exhausted, there have been no other cats come and replace those cats in the territory because it had been established for so long that it continues to stay empty. And when the areas around it have been managed the same way, you do eventually get a very small, insignificant population going. And so it works over the short term and it works over the long term.
So you really do believe that it's worth the time and ongoing responsibility of that, because, you know, I do. I mean, I see a need for, you know, there's a balance in nature. And I often say this, Penny, nature is beautiful. It's wonderful and to marvel at and behold, but it's also brutal. There's a balance, you know, a yin and yang, if you will. There is a wonderful balance there. And again, we need the predator in there to maintain the prey population. So, you know, and cats are a pure predator, so a pure carnivore. So again, in my opinion, I think it is worth the time and ongoing responsibility. But what is the reaction you often get?
Well, there's been an ongoing issue there with cats and over cats and birds and a few things like that. You get some of these things about whether the cats are eliminating the wild bird populations. And there's several things we have to realize. These are not, while they may have been wild cats a few hundred years ago when they came from Africa or Europe or something like that, these cats aren't from a wild resource. They have some innate abilities, but that's many generations back. They're opportunistic feeders. They eat what's easily available, and feral cats are scavengers. Many of them rely on just handouts from people, which is another reason that feeding them makes it much safer. Cats need to not rely on garbage, because in many cases what's in that garbage can be toxic if there's they're affected by the same foods that are toxic as our domestic animals, onions, chocolates, things like that. Second, cats are rodent specialists. Birds are a very small percentage of their diet when they rely solely on hunting for food. It's mostly small mammals. And third, as you say, cats can prey on a population without destroying it. If this were not so, we would no longer have mice around. And cats in these generations are many times not competent hunters. They enjoy the chase, and our heart goes to our throat when we see the squirrel or the bird with a cat in pursuit, but most only actually catch the prey occasionally. They don't catch many birds. They really were do mostly small mammals, and when they have done the studies, and when they have looked at a number of studies, they have found that habitat destruction is the biggest cause of a loss of bird populations. And in some cases, even other birds have been responsible for the demise of some species. So one example I can tell you about is a species of warbler that depended on wintering in western Cuba. Well, when western Cuba cleared most of the forest for sugarcane, that population was impacted in the U.S. also, because they had no place to winter. But that had nothing to do with the feral cats in the southeast being responsible for eating those birds.
So a lot of people who are you know, bird watchers, which I'm one of them, I love watching the wildlife, and that's why we always have water available for them all winter and a feeder. I just, I kind of maybe am a little bit more feet on the ground kind of person, and I think of it as it's there's a natural balance. So honestly, if people may not realize this, Penny, but I see hawks catching birds more than I see cats catching birds. I rarely have seen that. Like you say, I've seen them catch mice often enough, but again, not the bird population. It's always the hawks that are getting them, or, you know, some other larger predator bird. So it's birds killing birds more than it's cats killing birds, right?
Actually, you're right. And one thing I can tell people that is interesting, if you find a pile of feathers lying around and all you have there are a pile of feathers. That bird was not killed by a cat, because cats do not meticulously devour everything and leave the feathers in a neat little pile. That's a hawk trait. That's the hawks and the falcons that get small birds that way. One study that was done on a colony studied a colony from 1991 to 2002. This colony started out with 25 cats, and they had another colony that had 3 cats. I mean, they had varying ranges in there, but they went through a number of colonies totaling 155 cats. And every colony was reduced in number, and not one of them, even the ones with up to 25 cats, had more than 5 cats in it by the time the study was disbanded. And some of them never reestablished. So this was a study over many years and over a number of colonies and a large number of cats, and they came up with the same results. So there really is some good evidence that these things work.
Well, and again, everything in balance. I just, you know, there are going to be, it's just the way nature is, and there's a reason for it, or we'd have an overabundance of prey animals with plague and disease problems if we didn't have our wonderful predators out there keeping things in check. And so I think it's a nice balance, and it does something for the cats that have been abandoned by their irresponsible owners and people who don't want to do the right thing by their pets or think that they're dispensable, which they are not. And I can't say it any other way, but be more blunt than that, Penny. We have a few minutes left before we wind down this week's show, but I was curious as to how you care, and this is not about feral cats, but how you care for your own cats per se. I mean, I don't know if you're a raw feeder or if you just, you know, do a lot of natural modalities. I understand from your website that you do work in conjunction or believe in integrative medicine, as do we. So it would just be interesting to hear your take on that.
Okay. Well, there's a couple of things. I do use my Reiki quite often with the animals. That is a energy healing technique for those of you who may not be familiar with it. I find it helps them keep balanced and calm and keep everything, especially if they're having any upsets, it helps balance their system and allow them to heal better. I am not a raw feeder, but that is primarily because I have some animals with very special needs, and my vet is very holistically oriented, and we work together to find the boundaries there where we can do the natural care and where we have to resort to the allopathic care, because I have a kitty who has a disease that I can't even pronounce without looking it up, and I didn't look it up before the show. Where the teeth dissolve from the inside out, and it's quite common in large cats as well as small cats, but it actually is dissolving the teeth, and then it works its way into the bone and so on. And it's not something that can be cured through through normal methods or through medication or something like that. It's a cat genetic issue sometimes. Otherwise, I pretty much do rely on natural care. Once in a while, we get into things like supplements. I have a kitty who has an ongoing, like a kitty herpes virus, that has to have a lysine compounded into a tuna flavor and get a dose of that every day to keep the mouth sores down so that she can eat. And we do those kinds of things very frequently. We're very much in favor. Our dogs with their arthritis, our cats with their problems, the kitty with the disc sitting sideways in his back gets duralactin, which is a milk-based protein for arthritis, and it seems to work wonderfully. I've never found anything that was a prescription drug medicine that worked any better than this, and it works over the counter, and it's natural and doesn't have any side effects. So we go that way as much as we can, and we really work hard to eliminate foods and medicines that have side effects as much as possible and stay with those kinds of things that are natural.
It's really good to hear, and I actually probably gathered some of that from, you know, just from talking with you previously and also because of your website. And you know, you said some key words earlier. You said that you work together with your veterinarian, and that is something that we always encourage our listeners to understand, that when you go to a veterinarian, if you're trying to find a veterinarian for, you know, for your animals, that you're going to want to work with somebody who wants to work with you according to how you want to work, what work you want done for your animals. Because if you're not going to work together in some form of harmony, then I would move on to somebody who is willing to listen to you and hear you, because you live with your animal, you're your animal's best advocate, and know them the best. And so you want a veterinarian who's going to work with you. So Penny, that was great that you shared that. Do you have anything further you would like to share with our audience? And I, for one, am curious if you're having if you have another book coming out, or what kind of projects you have going on right now.
Oh gosh, well, I hope I'm planning on getting my book finished this year. I am working on a book dealing with the animals, obviously, with the adoption recipes for success. I got sidetracked because of a rather extensive hospitalization last year and some rehab on my own part, which really taught me the value of natural medicine, because the things that helped me the most were my own Reiki practitioner and the natural supplements. The only things that seemed to cause me problems came out of the drugstore, so I definitely boisters my confidence in those things. What else I have going is I am bringing out some color therapy products on my website, and I'm going to be adding to that. I haven't announced the grand opening or put out any ads on it yet, but I'll tell our audience and share it. Watch and see what we have going on. I have the Reiki for Paws website, and I'm adding the products which will deal with the color therapy. Again, that's a nice natural modality. The website is Reiki, R-E-I-K-I, number 4, Paws, P-A-W-S.com. And you can link off of the Pets by Penny site, too, that's on your, usually on the bios and things that you have on your site. And the color therapy is something that I'm finding has a is very, very nice with the animals. And it has a soothing effect, because colors have energy. Obviously, that's why we see various colors. And just as we sometimes find we prefer certain colors, if you find yourself wearing a certain color and then look up the properties of those colors, and many times you'll find that there's a reason. You're wearing pink because it's calming. You're wearing black because you feel powerful that day. You're wearing these various things. So check it out and see what it can do for the pets, too.
Well, Penny, it was wonderful having you with us again this week and sharing such great information, things that we probably haven't heard much about here on Animal Talk Naturally. And you can also go to Penny's other website, which is www.petsbypenny.com, and that's the one we also have linked on our site, but we'll have her other sites linked up on the bio at animaltalknaturally.com. So again, Penny, thank you for being with us. It was wonderful to have you with us this week.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it. I hope it was some valuable information for everyone. I look forward to talking to you again.
Well, thank you. We do too. We know it's valuable information. So please visit her website and keep an eye out for that book. I'm very eager to hear about that book, Penny. So and next week, we're going to have with us the founder of DrDoMore.com, Dr. Margot Roman. And that should be an interesting topic, as we're going to be talking about, from a veterinarian, how she is teaching people to empower pet owners with knowledge. And that sounds almost like our motto. Anyway, we'd like to give a big thank you and shout out to Peter Yankee at coolcastradio.com and ilearnradio.org for streaming us every day, and for our CD fulfillment at bxmedia.net, and Bill Clanton at allpetsradio.com for streaming us every Wednesday. Thank you. We love you guys. You are invited to join us live every Wednesday as we record at www.holistic-pet-audio.com at 2:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And you can find Jeannie at www.theholedog.org, and her blog is wholedognews.com. I'm at aspenbloompetcare.com, and Shadrach does all my blogging for me at bark-n-blog.com. And that's all for this week. This is Kim Bloomer of animaltalknaturally.com. In a spirit of love and truth, we hope you all have a tail wagging week. The Animal Talk Naturally podcast is a production of Animal Talk Naturally, all rights reserved, and may not be resold without express written permission. The advice, views, and opinions expressed by our hosts, guests, and other contributors are only suggestions and not meant to replace actual medical care for yourself or your animals. Thank you.